Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight, where both Rebecca Huntley and Tanvir Ahmed make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of their recent books. I'll introduce both speakers first very briefly. Rebecca Huntley is well known, or both our speakers are well known. Rebecca's a researcher on social trends, a broadcaster and author. Most recently of Still Lucky, Why You Should Feel Optimistic About Australia and Its People. And of course, Rebecca Huntley holds degrees in law and film studies and a PhD in gender studies, and she's been done a lot of work around opinion studies and whatever else. And Tanvir Ahmed is a Sydney-based psychiatrist who works in private practice, and he's author of Fragile Nation, Vulnerability, Resilience and Victimhood. And so we're going to lead off with Rebecca, and then we go to Tanvir, then we go to questions and discussion. Rebecca, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the Hendersons for inviting me yet again to speak at the Sydney Institute. It's always a pleasure. The little information about my background, it said that I did a film studies degree, and I want to acknowledge my film studies professor at the time. This is 25 years ago, Peter Gerdes. He's sitting here. He always comes to hear me speak. He looks exactly the same as he did 25 years ago. I do not. I look very different. I was at a bit of a... I had to have a think about what I was going to share with you today. The book covers quite a lot that I've found in terms of attitudes about Australians in the last 10 years. So chapters on attitudes to asylum seekers, to the economy, to politics, to patriotism. But I thought it might be a good theme, given we're a double act tonight, as I talk a little bit about men. And there's a chapter on women and there's a chapter on men. The chapter on women is called Why Are Women Underpaid and Overworked? I almost called it Why Are Australian Women Martyrs? I've been quite... Some people say I'm quite tough on Australian women in this chapter, and I'm quite easy on Australian men in my chapter, which is strange because I consider myself a feminist. My father was very happy. He texted me and said he read the book and he thought I was very kind to old men in it and very sympathetic. But I think one of the reasons why that's the case is that most of the research I've done for the last 10 years has been with friendship groups. So traditional social market research normally gathers a whole lot of people together in a kind of seminar room with one of those, kind of NYPD mirrors where there's people at the back and you can't see them, one of those kinds of rooms. And the strangers all sit there and are kind of encouraged to talk. But the kind of research that I've done mostly for the last 10 years has been in people's homes across the nation with an already existing group of friends. So in a sense, even though I haven't really experienced the full gamut of Australian masculinity, but I have experienced what it's like for men to have a close and intimate group of friends. So perhaps I've had a skewed view of Australian masculinity. But anyway, the chapter that I'm going to read from you a bit about today is called Why Don't Men Have Friends? It's a deliberately provocative question, but it's one that's come up time and again, not only from clients and groups, but it's one I asked myself over the 10 years in which I was the director of the Mind and Mood Report, because in order for us to conduct these groups, we had to recruit six to eight people who are part of a tight friendship group. Of all the ages and backgrounds that we struggled, the hardest group to recruit were men in their 30s and 40s. There was something about those two decades, and it might be because of intense work, all kinds of things. I talk a little bit about it. It was very, very difficult to get to find those groups of men and to get them to commit to a time. And in fact, occasionally these male hosts would say, I'm sorry, only two of my mates turned up tonight. We're not really good at friendship. So why might Australian men have difficulty with friendship? It's ironic because we are a culture based on the notion that mateship is almost like supposed to be one of our national characteristics. We're a culture that valorises men's friendships, whether it be on the battlefield or in the surf or anything else like that. I don't think we can say lack of time is... Well, lack of time I don't think is a convincing reason. I think that lack of time is used as an excuse for so much at the moment. And the reason why I have some research to back this up. This isn't just I'm not just on a one of those annoying talking head panels talking about stuff that I don't already know. This is my opinion, therefore it must be true. It was interesting. So one of the many sources for my book was the National Centre of Social Economic Modelling does a lot of work for AMP. They did a really interesting report in 2011 called Race Against Time: How Australians Spend Their Time. What they found is that men have an extra 30 minutes on average per day for leisure activities compared to women. Women spend slightly more time on voluntary work and social and community action interaction. So men actually have more time for friendships than women have. But I've got to say, they just aren't spending that time. They're often spending that time on their own doing things rather than with other friends, with other male friends. What I've seen in my research is the ability for men to thrive socially and emotionally later in life is absolutely shaped by the decisions they make in their earlier decades. And the men who have maintained friendships through these difficult years, these 30s and 40s years, the real difficult decades in which we had real difficulty trying to find these male friendship groups, they often seem to fare better through semi and full retirement decades of 50s, 60s and 70s. One of the other pieces of research, not done by me, but done by the mental health charity Beyond Blue, they actually did a study on Australian male men and friendships. It included 14 discussion groups, so it's a pretty good sample, and an online survey of over 4,000 men, which is an excellent sample. They found that one in four, that's the equivalent of 1.1 million Australian men, have few or no social connections and have no one to talk to when they're unhappy. And that it is common, and this isolation and loneliness is most common in men between 30 and 65 years of age. So obviously that really quite a long period of time, but the years of work. The peak time for men to neglect their friendship, the research found, was the ages 35 to 54. So late 30s, 40s and early 50s. It found that men often lacked the skills and impetus to remedy the situation. Half the respondents reported they rarely talked about deeper issues with their friends, and some of them, just over 30%, reported they didn't even talk about shallow issues. And the other thing I thought was interesting here is there was some dissatisfaction about this, but perhaps not as much as you would expect. 31% wish they could open up more to their friends, and 28% wish their friends would open up more to them. I wonder if it was so low because they felt they didn't have the skills. If their friends did open up to them, what might they possibly say? I also thought the thing I found quite interesting is that Beyond Blue research showed that only 5% of men surveyed would get together with other men just for a chat. Now, that's something that women do all the time. This was in contrast to the most popular activity amongst men, which was going to the pub, which accounted for 22% of all men's social activity. So we're a culture which has this kind of, you know, quite strange Bridget Jones stereotype of pathetic, single, childless career women choking to death in their apartments, being eaten by their cats. But actually, my experience is that single women are much, much better at creating support networks of friends and colleagues than men are, single or otherwise. I had hoped in my research of the last 10 years that I would see some generational shifts here. In my time as a researcher, I did numerous studies on people in their late teens and early 20s and including in their early teens. And this dynamic, this view that girls' friendships are intense and girls are really supportive and collegiate, also there are downsides to that, and that boys are friends by doing things was still intact, not just by the, not just a view from the parents, but also from the young people themselves. And so this kind of idea that men form friendships by doing things and they open up by doing things, well, you can understand once men start getting really into their careers and working and the doing ends because they're doing so much work, you can understand that their friendships are bound to suffer. In a, the research that I've done over the last 10 years when people talk about the workplace and what that has changed about the workplace that they dislike, one of the things that has struck me is the extent to which men really miss the social activity around the workplace. So it's particularly older men, in my experience, that have said they, one of the downsides of everybody being so pressured at work and everybody being so time poor is the idea of kind of the smoko, the office drinks and all the rest of it, that not that stopping. And they're saying, well, it's, you know, it's all about work and it's not by, by about having fun. So the social aspects of work that used to be so important, everybody used to have the time and the bandwidth to do that, the fact that that goes is yet another area where men have been blocked off from social activity. I have to say, because I've generally done research with groups of men who are already enjoying the benefits of friendship, I often hear about some of these lonely, isolated men indirectly from the women in their life. One woman that I met a couple of years ago was talking about her brother-in-law. His wife had died 18 months ago. He was 69. He was struggling with loneliness. Most of his friends had partners. It never occurred to his friends who had partners to spend some time one-on-one with this man who was a widower. And again, not something that would happen a lot of the time with women. And a lot of reflection, every now and then, you know, I have met groups of, in a group of men, one man who's either been recently divorced or partner has died, and they are capable of talking about just the emptiness of what happens to them. But again, able to reflect with that in their group of friendships with men, and so very therapeutic. I think one of the things I used to always, before I did this research, I used to look at couples who'd been married for 50 years, who'd divorced, and I thought, you're a quitters. You've only got about 10 or 15 years. Just, you know, just kind of, just keep on there. Why would you possibly divorce after 50 years or 40 years or even 30 years? But having spent time with Australians, I absolutely understand why this happens. Once the children have finally gone, and sometimes they go back and forth and back and forth, but once they're gone and you look over the table at the, you know, person slurping their Weet-Bix, you think to yourself, I've got 10 more years of life and I'm not going to spend it with you. But one of the things I have noticed is that men who are prepared to maintain friendships and have a life outside their relationship and their children and their job tend to fare better. With being retired, therefore, the impact on their relationship isn't quite as bad. One of my favourite stories in the last 10 years was one experience I had in Adelaide in 2010. I was in a very well-to-do suburb of Adelaide. I arrived. It was a very hot day. I was meeting a group of women in their early 70s, all of whom were part of a church craft circle. So they're all knitters and they're all, committed churchgoers. It was a beautiful house. They were all drinking out of their lovely china teapot tea cups, and we were talking about all kinds of things, but their biggest issue was all of their husbands who'd been very, very recently retired and had really thrown themselves into their jobs. Their job was their entire identity. All of them were finding retirement incredibly difficult, and all of these women were finding their partners incredibly difficult as a result. One of them complained that all he does is sit there and look at the business news and worry about what's happening with the superannuation. The other one didn't want the grandchildren coming over because they were too loud. They went on and on and on and on. At the end of this 1.5 hours, I asked a question to these ladies. I said, look, now at this stage of your life, what are your goals, you know, for the next 10 or 15 years? And one, the hostess said to me, well, actually, I tend to not look at them while I'm speaking because I like them to look at themselves and pretend that I'm not there. So I was writing in my notebook. And she said, It's not so much of a goal as a dream. It's a dream that all our husbands will die at the same time so we can go on a cruise. And I looked up and I thought it was a joke. No one was laughing. Everybody was, yes, that would be lovely. It would be just, wouldn't it be great? And so these gentle church-going ladies wanted their husbands dead so they could enjoy daiquiris on the first day of the funship before the Alzheimer's really kicked in. So it was that stage that I realised it's actually incredibly important for the general survival of old men that they continue to have friendships and an exciting life and an interesting life outside work so they can maintain really healthy relationships into old age. The other wonderful story that I can share with you about this, and this really showed me the benefits of friendship, particularly not just for everybody, but particularly for men, was an experience I had the very same year in Dubbo. And I arrived, it was a kind of large house. It had 7 utes were parked on the front lawn. It was like a little ute muster just there. There was also a kind of an extremely large Australian flag on a kind of pole at the front, and I thought, well, I'm in for an afternoon. So I arrived, and these men were all in their kind of early 70s, ex-army, ex-coppers, ex-truck drivers, all of them. And I sat down, and the host said to me, oh, look, we're just, you know, we're on a health kick, so we've just got the powder of, you know, fruit and vegetables here, but I made the hummus myself. And I said, oh, good on you. And I listened to these men. They were very, very close. Some of them had really experienced a lot, post-traumatic stress, particularly in the COPS. But they had maintained incredibly close friendship, mainly because they'd all kind of grown up in Dubbo together. They were really enjoying retirement. One of the men said to me, retirement is a wonderful phase of my life. I renewed my life. I got to know my wife better than I ever had time to. We've talked so much. You finally realise where you went wrong. It's an opportunity to put things right as much as you can. All of these grandfathers were, most of them were grandfathers. Most of them were very active in the lives of their grandkids. Some of them were even more excited that more babies were coming along. They were incredibly... They had decided to kind of step into the domestic realm a bit, partly because some of their wives were still in a bit of work and doing some volunteer work. And so they were all cooking. In fact, they decided as a group to hire a nutritionist to take them around the local supermarket to teach them how to shop. They were all enthusiastic cooks. They had a very large conversation. We've got a animated conversation about how to cook a turkey on the barbecue. And, you know, I just was really pretty much blown away by how you know, at this stage of their life when they've been through a lot, about how their relationships, their marriages, their relationship with their children, their grandchildren and their community was sustaining them in their older age. And really, as a group, they were very involved in the local RSL club, and one of the things they had decided to do was create a club for carers. So instead of a childcare club, if you were a carer for somebody who was either living with a disability or or somebody who was elderly, you could take them to the RSL club. These guys would put on, you know, backgammon and cards and all the rest of it, and that carer could go off and get their hair done or do some shopping or spend some time on their own. That was a bit of a contrast to the poor men who were about to get it, probably a bit of poison in the tea, from the husbands of the women in Adelaide. So a bit of a contrast about just the benefits in older age of what it is to maintain those relationships, even when it was difficult. And these men had extremely difficult jobs that kept them away from home. That caused an enormous amount of stress and unhappiness. I wonder whether the power of friendship could encourage more men to prioritise their caring responsibilities, and I believe it can. I see it in groups of women who become mums together for the first time, and they bond through existing friendships or through mothers' group, or if friends are all pregnant at the same time. They really, it's those relationships, you know, either friendships that have already existed where you have children at the same time, or people that you meet. These are the women that you ring up to say, oh, can you pick up my child because my car's broken down. They're the ones that drop off the spaghetti bolognese when you've got an issue in your life. And I think that it would be wonderful if we could see more men embracing that. For a whole range of reasons, men aren't taking long periods of paternity leave. That's not necessarily just because they don't want to be active parents. There's a whole reason around that. But really, only one in 50 Australian men take the full amount of paternity leave, of parental leave. And I think for those who do, it can be a relatively solitary experience. So I have done one-on-one interviews with men who've decided to take the 6 months, and they just feel a bit weird going along to the mother's group with a whole lot of other women. They sometimes feel a bit strange stalking around with a child and trying to talk to other women in the playground. They always think that those women think that they're trying to pick them up. And these men have said, I'm so exhausted. I don't think I could. I can't even pick up my own wife, let alone pick up somebody I'm going to meet at the playground. But I think it can be a really solitary experience. So I think there's an opportunity there. The more men take it, the more there's comfort in numbers. I went into this book perhaps being a little bit cynical about Australian masculinity, but I've come out thinking it is shifting slowly but surely. I think that there's a big role that women can play in ensuring that they support men in the kinds of changes that they might want to make in their lives. And I want to end here with one of the Dubbo granddads that I talked to. This is about the ability of men to change. Never underestimate it. This man had so many tattoos. I mean, he was absolutely, he was burnt to a crisp. He was a truck driver, so he had truck driver arms. They were completely brown and lots of tats. He was very, very thin. He was the one who had a very particular view about how you do a turkey on the barbecue. Anyway, he was now at the age of 78, completely responsible for all the tasks around the home. And he said, do the washing up, throw stuff in the washing machine. It's not very hard to do. Here we go.
Thanks, Rebecca. Lovely privilege to share the stage with Rebecca, who I've long admired. And I mean, in many respects, we do quite fairly similar jobs. We're effectively social researchers. Hers, I guess, in a more kind of a formal, in a large numbers, if you like, where mine's highly individual, with a slightly different relationships in terms of authority or why people come to me. So I'm a psychiatrist. I work primarily in Western Sydney, but fly regionally, visit jails. And I guess that informs this book called Fragile Nation, which is, about the cultural rise of mental health and what I contend are the meanings of that, the broader meanings of that beyond, the academic discipline itself. And I guess there's a focus on different cultural groups, and that's partly because of the demographics of where I work. Also my interests, prior to, while I was doing medicine, I was doing an arts degree briefly, and I took an interest in anthropology and just my own background. I'm born in Bangladesh. I'm effectively the child of, if not Bangladeshi villages, of parents who spent their entire childhoods in Bangladeshi villages. And it's certainly given me, an extra interest in traditional cultures and traditional backgrounds, if you like. So that informs my book. And I think Rebecca's been kind to her. She's honed in on a specific topic, and I'll certainly bounce off that a little. But I'll talk about some of the broad themes of my book. I want to kind of define what we even mean by mental health. It's such a widely used term. It's largely become a synonym for emotional distress now. But I just want to talk about, the technical meaning of it. It's really three different disciplines. So one is neuroscience, which is really, the biological aspect of mental illness and emotions. The chemistry of emotions and what we feel and think has a chemical signature delineated by neurotransmitters, hormones, etc. So that's one branch of mental health, and hence you have, say, the serotonin theory of depression, etc., and why Australia has the second highest use of antidepressants in the OECD. So that comes out of a neuroscientific
idea of mental illness and emotions. So another aspect is behaviourism, which is essentially what psychologists do. So that underpins what, say, the average psychologist would work in. And some of you would remember, say, Pavlov's dogs, the dog sort of drooling just before the bell rung because he associated with food. So that behaviourism really is about reward, punishment, how we make associations, and how some of what we behave is directly related to what we consciously think. So essentially psychologists work on, can we alter your thoughts, thereby we alter how you feel and or how you behave. So that's effectively what cognitive behavioural therapy, which is what most psychologists do. And I guess the final branch of the technical meaning of mental health is psychoanalysis, which is probably most closely to the popular idea of psychiatry. Essentially, it's couches and bearded Teutonic elders, if you like. And psychoanalysis is really about our primitive selves. It's how our instincts and desires must be tamed, if you like, to live in what we call society. But they're always playing out in the background. And that's, I guess, Freud's one of his biggest contributions among many, this idea of the unconscious, that so much of what we do and how we behave. And I guess this is a key area that, you know, where Rebecca and our work would differ, because so much of what people say has no relationship with what they actually think or the way they behave or their deeper drives and instincts, if you like. So this notion of mental health then plays out at a time when Western societies have become largely post-religious in many respects. The majority of our population no longer structure their lives around organised religion. And for that reason, I often joke that say I'm like a secular priest, because most people now make sense of their lives to a large degree through the language of psychology and through the language of mental health. And I guess some more to add there, half a century ago, we might have had characters, and we still have characters to an extent, but increasingly, really, we have personalities. The character has become the personality, and there's different overtones. So the character had a moral overtone. The personality is about self-presentation, in how we kind of present ourselves to the outside world, to society, if you like. So that's quite a big change, and that also means a lot of moral discussions then fall into the realm of psychology, be it, instead of being angry and smashing up stuff, you might have intermittent explosive disorder, antisocial personality disorder instead of being, say, a crib or something like that. So a lot of psychologisation, a lot of old moral questions. So that's a key shift, if you like. And one of the chapters where I talk about adolescence and adolescent mental health, and where I talk to a whole bunch of people and link it with my patients to whether there's a definite view of, in mental health now, certainly a big debate, whether adolescents have unique pressures compared to any other generation. And I think it overlaps with some of that, where this overlap of personality, self-presentation, and to a little bit, certainly not caused by, but then magnified by social media. And underneath that is a broader shift in life's project. So in the last half century, life's project is about individual self-fulfillment. And this goes to the heart of the cultural rise of mental health. So many of us are, I guess, fine-tuning our psychological well-being in our quest for this amorphous idea of self-fulfillment, which essentially can leave us fragile, can leave us vulnerable, if you like, if it feels like I'm not adequately fulfilled, therefore my life doesn't have quite the meaning that I think it has, and then you're far more prone to some sort of despair in a metaphysical and physiological sense. So this is really the underpinning of my book, which is a series of patients and looking at how do these groups, particularly groups that come from societies where there's really no significance of a private, personal realm. So that's uniquely Western, particularly in the last century, that there's something called the private, personal realm that has significance. And again, that comes out of psychoanalysis, Freud, and that really drove many aspects of the 20th century. This notion of desire, particularly for minority groups, that I have a private desire that needs to be unleashed and listened to and fulfilled. And that's driven a lot of the upheaval, if you like, particularly post-war. And one of the things I point to is that barely a few decades ago, this emphasis on my desires has shifted a bit, and it overlaps with the cultural rise in mental health, where in some ways now people are more likely to talk about their pain or their weakness. It's almost a type of status, so hence we have far more people coming out talking about that aspect. So that's a big shift in Western societies. Another key player here is the decline of collective institutions. And, you know, I'm hardly the first person to talk about that, be it political parties, unions, churches, you name it. And the significance of that is increasingly, you know, we talk about, say, political fault lines, you know, historically, be it labour, capital, etc. Increasingly, where people's day-to-day politics often plays out is this realm of individual versus society. So in many, how do I build myself? How, what are my attitudes? What's my relationship to broader society? Or another way to think of it is the spectrum between private distress and public politics. And this is where that relationship is critical. And often that is playing out in my rooms, where people come in with a whole range of resentments and anger, which they might be channeling to the outside world. And part of my job is to kind of sift through to what extent is it the outside world or their individual, I guess, coping or their autonomous selves. And hence, there's been such a rise of so many resentment-based political movements recent, be it Islamic extremism, be it white nationalism, radical feminism, men's rights movements. All of them have some basis of truth behind them, but they're heavily laced with personal resentments and failures projected onto the outside world. And one of the things I'm arguing is I contend that our measures of so many kinds of psychological harm, be they prejudice or abuse, trauma, have been steadily diluted in recent decades. And as a result, we've become very sensitive to perceiving psychological harm, but also more likely to attribute the cause of that harm from external sources and not our innate, say, coping vulnerabilities. Now, a key example I relate in one of my chapters is that of post-traumatic stress disorder, which began as an unpredictable, objectively life-threatening event, but is now treated in many scenarios as something that was subjectively difficult. So this is a very big change. It's a very interesting, important analogy for how we view the human being. And just as we're going through disruptive times in a whole range of arenas, our views around human nature are in flux. And this is, I guess, a key point of my book. So prior to the Vietnam War, PTSD, or shell shock, as we might have called it previously, was understood to be rare and occurred mainly in people who already had some kind of pre-existing vulnerability. Now we view war as innately traumatic in the longer term. In Victoria, legislation is being considered to consider the work of paramedics and police as innately traumatic. Now, that's a big shift, and I'll explain why. So basically, if we've gone from a shift where we saw it as extremely rare, affected mainly people who had some vulnerability, to the trauma, or how we view the trauma as being the cause. And I contend that's a kind of analogy to how we've shifted from viewing the human being as fundamentally resilient to now, in our societies, as seeing them and constructing them increasingly as fundamentally fragile or fundamentally vulnerable. And so suddenly psychological harm becomes a much bigger element in our politics, if you like, be it in workplace relations, free speech, a whole range of arenas. It becomes a fault line, which it previously may not have been. Coming back to... coming back to this idea of changing notions of human nature, I sort of profile several patients of mine who sort of joined white nationalist or men's rights group, and this will overlap a bit of what Rebecca was talking about. Some of the themes that come out of there, feelings of being discarded, that their local areas were no longer recognisable. This is very interesting, and if you look at Brexit supporters, just this idea of the local was a very interesting theme, that suddenly what they thought was local no longer felt local. They were unfairly labelled privileged, being white and male, when that was very far from their own experience. And being a psychiatrist, many of them were from fatherless families. And I think this is probably an under-discussed trend in a lot of the big global trends. You know, arguably we've had one of the biggest generations who've grown up without their biological father in the household. And, you know, figures like Trump, etc., are the ultimate psychiatrist. And authoritarianism more general is a huge yearning for the primeval father figure. So I think that's an interesting... I think it's at least something of a contributor to some of the trends going on. Now, almost all of these groups had sort of their own psychological frailties, and as I've said before, most were projecting it outwards. And my job was to recognise that a lot of their distress had internal origins. And I think this has a lot of overlaps with politics. In many ways, the left took on lots of things about Freud and psychoanalysis, particularly about desire, around minority groups, this kind of thing. But what it left, to some respect, was this idea of an autonomous self that had its own coping vulnerabilities. So that really affects the balance of that private distress and public politics. So a lot of leftist politics is that people feel distressed and they're like, oh, it's the fault of power structures, if you like. So I think this is a key fault line of politics that has big psychological overlaps. Now, a bit more about the white working class male in particular, and I have a chapter devoted to that, and this will overlap a little bit what Rebecca was talking about. Arguably, the past half century of progressive thought is rooted in part psychologically to taming traditional masculinity, which was sometimes referred to as toxic masculinity. I mean, that's where Hillary sort of almost came across as this sort of overbearing headmistress, kind of telling the naughty boys to sit in the corner. And I guess Trump was the ultimate kind of naughty boy. So this is a kind of... Trump is like the Freudian id of Western civilization. And arguably, the half century of progressivism... And you know, if you believe the faults of the left are sometimes they would like humans to be how they would like them to be, and not as they are. Arguably, the last half century has been a steady kind of pushing down of a lot of what we might consider what might have been called primitive aspects of man, but were arguably just features of human nature. And a lot of that was, you know, possibly regulated by a host of trends, not least, say, political correctness. So I think that's where Trump, you know, is an overreach of our primitive selves in a way. I guess some other trends I talk about. One point I'd make about Rebecca and relationships, I thought that was very interesting what she was saying, and it does overlap with one of my chapters. One of the patients I talk about is this woman being one of the, I think I'm the only qualified Bangladeshi private psychiatrist, and even though my Bengali is fairly ordinary, I attract patients all over the place. Because I can speak Bengali. So often I get a newly arrived, arranged marriage women, and they'll come with certain expectations, and often they're from very middle-class families, and they turn up, and they think they're coming to some sort of household. You know, one of the patients I talk about, she thought she married a transportation executive. He turned up, and he was a taxi driver. Right? but this is where there's a huge gap in negotiation. So a lot of ordinary men here have very big negotiating potential through their permanent visa, Australian permanent visa. But one thing I talk about is how the nature of arranged marriage has changed, largely because intimate relationships have changed. Now, some of the things Rebecca was talking about, the males have less friends. But yes, a lot of trends are they have much closer relationships to their partners. So they become their key confidant, their best friend, everything, which is different to a half century ago. But it's true that they have fewer friends. But this has affected, not an area that we'd hear about in the mainstream press. An area this has whittled away is the arranged marriage. Traditionally, the arranged marriage was cushioned, if you like, by clan, tradition, extended families. So there wasn't as much pressure on the two individuals. So suddenly now, and I see, you know, some patients along those lines, and I think it's actually a real social problem, to be honest, where lots of people have arranged marriage driven mainly by migration desires, and they come here and they're disasters because individually they don't get on. Huge difference between attitudes, traditional versus modern, wanting autonomy, empowerment versus... it's odd. Many people, women come and they feel like they've gone back to their parents' villages, you know. But a lot of arranged marriages fail because the nature of relationships have changed. And a lot of these patients come to me with more symptoms, usually physical symptoms. So they've seen a neurologist for a headache, this, and after they've had the ring around, they come to me. And they're the classic patients where they have this whole new way of having to think about themselves, and they're stuck in outer Sydney. They've come from Taka or Lahore, and they have to think about themselves entirely afresh in this kind of psychological language. So that's a big theme of my book. So So look, just some quick themes, because we do have questions. I'll just finish up. So another some key trends. One thing I talk about is the search for authenticity in people. And this links people from the Islamic extremist. And I have a patient who's a Pakistani teenager who comes to me socially anxious, can't go to school, but the way he shows it is a very long beard. Right, and this encompasses a few things. It shows a degree of social exclusion. It's also a way of hiding, and also it's an extension of anger. It's anger as well, and so is the hijab sometimes. But as he improves, the way he shows it, the way he communicates it, as he finds work, etc., suddenly his beard gets shorter and shorter. He starts trimming it and becomes kind of... So then it becomes a fashion statement to the outside world, but still a signal to Muslims that, hey, I am still kind of religious. Hey, you know. So it kind of brings together those elements. But what they're often looking for is an authentic version of Islam. And we saw that a bit when the whole Yasmin Abdul-Majid affair, which she talked about, she argued that these are all cultural practices. So this is a very unique Western trend where Muslims self-formulate its individual expression. So it's very Western, because it's how I am and I'm showing my religion. But these trends of authenticity, trying to find our authentic selves, come out in a whole manner of ways. Another patient I talk about is looking for he's become a raw food enthusiast. He practices alternative medicine. These are all searches for purity and authenticity. And it comes out, and people channel their politics through food as well. So these are broad brush trends where people, that we live in a post-religious secular, but people channel the sacred, the search for purity, the authentic, in these private, personal realms. I'll shut up there. But right, we'll have questions.
Well, thanks to both our speakers. Shannon Grundy's got copies of Rebecca Huntley's Still Lucky, Why You Should Feel Optimistic About Australia and Its People, and Tanvir's Fragile Nation, Vulnerability, Resilience and Victimhood. And so we come to question and discussion. There are a lot of people here. We don't have a lot of time. So let's be very brief. Just as we start off, half a century ago, virtually no one spoke about stress. Is it because there wasn't much stress around, or is it because fashions have changed? Where did all this emphasis on stress come from, which didn't seem to be... If you read the literature of a century ago and earlier, no one seemed to speak much about it. So just some quick responses, and then we'll go on. I think if you both stand up here...
Yeah. I'll disappear over here. Just some quick responses.
Yeah.
I'll give it very quick. I mean, the short answer is, yeah, the way we formulate our experience is different. I mean, stress, I guess, is a synonym for anxiety. And I think it does overlap with broader trends of life's project, about fulfilment, about how we project ourselves, about self-presentation. There are certainly, you know, a host of new pressures, but I think underpinning it is still an emphasis on just the purpose of life. I think that's shifted fairly dramatically. And about this pressure to be fulfilled, to find your authentic self, all this sort of stuff. And this adds an underpinning, if you like, an urgency around life that flows on through language such as stress and anxiety.
Yeah, look, I think that there's lots of really easy answers to say what's around now that wasn't around, you know, 50 years ago. But I'll share two things with you. I remember once doing a big study on people's attitudes to debt, and one man said something really clever. He said, if you don't say that you're stressed and busy in our society, it's like saying you're a loser. He said, you know, everybody says, oh, I'm really busy, I'm really stressed, lots happening, I've got, you know, big debts and all the rest of it. It's almost like a new modern badge of courage. If you say, I'm really relaxed, you know, I'm not that busy, I'm not doing anything on Saturday night. You know, it's really honestly like... For certain groups of in our society, it's like an admission of being boring. So I think there is a little bit about that we are in this accelerating culture, and if we all need to run at the same pace. One of the saddest pieces of research that I ever did there were some sad parts of it. I did a piece of research on young Australians becoming teenagers, and I compared it to a piece of research that Hugh McKay did, exactly the same piece of research he'd done 20 years previously. Pretty much most of it the same, except obviously a lot of stuff about technology. But the one thing that was interesting is that what had crept into the language of this 12 and 13-year-old kids was schedule, stress, pressure. And I remember one 11-year-old boy said, I'm totally ready for the pressures of year 8. I've done a time management course. This was not a kid at a really exclusive school, by the way, local public school. And that language that we have, that for whatever reason it's come, whether it be external or internal, has suddenly been adopted by that generation. It was there in that report in a way it wasn't 20 years ago.
There's a question here, Jeff. Oh, just speak up.
It seems to me that what was characteristic of the early part of my life in the 50s and 60s, early 60s and so on, was that everybody had been through the Depression and the war, and they were real pressures. And when they were gone, everybody just wanted to get on, and it wasn't the absorption with yourself so much as, you know, life was so much better than it had been, that you had it good.
Yeah. I mean, you might have something to say about that. I think there are so many consequences of, let's say, decades and decades of affluence. And while we've had international conflict, we haven't had anything like those wars. Mm. A lot of Australians forget that, you know, they might reflect on it. The people that really understand that, really understand just how fortunate we are asylum seekers. In the research I've done with them, they are the most patriotic Australians. They think this country is unbelievable. But they will say things like, I love this country, nobody's trying to kill me. But I remember, again, one of my favourite groups that I've ever done in the last 10 years was with a group of 40-year-old Somali men, Somali asylum seekers, and they were talking about Australia, how great it was, blah, blah, blah. But they were talking about watching Australian television, and one of the guys said, I watch a lot of Australian television just to learn the English language and understand Australia. He said, and I love it all, but I don't like Home and Away. And I said, why? And I said, why are all those good-looking, wealthy people who live by the sea so unhappy? and I think that's quite a good statement to make, which is really like, there's a lot of challenges that our nation faces, but we're a lot of good-looking, wealthy people who live by the sea, and in general, we've got a lot we should be optimistic about.
Thanks, Rebecca. I was just thinking of that man watching TV. God, I hope he doesn't have Foxtel watching these Rich Housewives shows. Jesus Christ. I guess some broad points. So, yeah, look, there's no question. So, I mean, the underpinning of our talk, we live in the most prosperous, peaceful times in history. And often, if you're an immigrant, I'd go beyond asylum seekers. And the average immigrant, when they arrive, I mean, you know, most people, even, to be honest, I had a cousin turn up on the weekend as an international student, and that's driving so much of our migration. And he'd only been in a week, but he was like, oh, there's no real problems in Australia, is there? Sort of. And I mean, he'd seen a little bit of the world, but certainly for immigrants, Australia seems like a kind of cul-de-sac, kind of sheltered, that there's really not much going. People whinge about various relatively trivial things. I think that's a very common thing. I've got another good example is the property debate, because often when I hear people whinging about property, often it's friends of mine that went to private schools and are now in the cultural industries. They're writing a screenplay, and really they're angry that they can't live where their parents live. They can't live in Woollahra or something. And I look at friends who are immigrants or relatives. They're working their guts out. They're doing 3 jobs, etc. And they'll buy something. They'll buy Quakers Hill. They'll buy Minto, and it's a huge source of pride. And you know, they're thrilled that they'd have those opportunities. So it's another example. There is a huge. I think we are whingers to a degree. The Depression's interesting times. So often it's about roles. The Depression is a time where women's roles were actually heightened. And if you look at actually mental health data, it was a time. I guess the Depression still brings this. The broader thing we can argue: do we have broad, overarching themes of collective identity? That's a bigger argument we could make, and that's something that goes right across the mental health spectrum. Where do we have broader themes of collective identity, and can you have a society now? Individuals make their sacred structure, but can we have a society? And this, you know, people have debated, philosophers have debated this for ages. So, in a post-religious society, can we have a country or a nation without an overarching sacred structure, or can individuals just go around forming their own little, you know, bits of the sacred? I think that brings that for me, and you know, people, I said underneath some of that is why is there seems to be so much angst are some of those underlying themes.
So I just wanted to add one thing that made me think about that. I think one of the consequences of generations of affluence and having a large percentage of the population not remembering, not having lived through a national challenge like a war or depression, is that mustering people as a community together to bring about a sustained response to a national challenge, whether it be climate change or restructuring the economy, is much harder. You know, and it's also much harder because the language of sacrifice that was so easily spoken by our leaders at that time just does not fall very well from the mouths of any political leader, regardless of political persuasion. They start getting up and saying, look, we've all got to sacrifice. I mean, they're going to have cans thrown at them. They're howled down, and because of the level of cynicism. So the kind of collective response, so Turner's comment about collectivism is interesting. So this idea of, like, how do we as a community come together as a group to mount a sustained response to a national challenge, and how do our leaders talk about sacrifice? These are increasingly hard things to do after these long periods of affluence.
Now we're going to finish at the top of the hour. So
Sorry. Look, a question to both of you from different perspectives. I can't believe that the win to Trump in November or the rise of Paul and Hanson comes because a whole heap of people are having a mental breakdown. So from your research in different ways, could you each explain what it is behind this new phenomenon, which is rather strident, rather angry, but also very disillusioned, and seems to be coming from a need in many people who seem to have been forgotten? Could either of you explain it, or both of you?
I'll do it quickly. I think one of the mistakes of the left has been to characterise... I won't talk about Trump because I don't understand that, and all the polls show that Australians might be... aren't a big fan of him, but Pauline Hanson does have support, more in some states than others, but... More importantly, there are people who will vote for her, and there are people that will not vote for her that think she has a point on some issues, right? Or politicians like her. So the mistake of the left has been to characterise the Pauline Hanson voter as economically disenfranchised and to only see it through that frame. There are other cultural, social issues that are driving that are complex. And have not been... I mean, it's hard for the left to talk about those kinds of questions. So there is an anger. There is that... So when Tammy was talking about the angry white men who are kind of interested in the men's movement, they're very much... Pauline Hanson is speaking to them. And it's not just because they're finding it hard to earn a crust. There's a whole other stuff that's happening there. And part of that is nostalgia for a world they probably didn't even grow up in, and part of that is a loss of status which they find hard to articulate, but they feel it. And it's not enough for the left to say that's misogyny. That might be part of it. We've got to come to grips with it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I don't think the answer necessarily in psychology. I think a lot of it is political economy. But I guess from my point of view, I'd go back to that point I was making about private distress and public politics. So I think there was a focus on the left on psychology and authenticity rather than, say, jobs for the working class. So they've become more interested. The classic was, I remember some interviews after the Trump where it got elected and, they found some guy at the bar and he was saying, you know why he got elected? The biggest issue in our friend group in a New York bar was trans port toilets, something like this. But that's a classic example. It is actually an interesting example because it's a classic example. I feel something, therefore it's true. Right, so arguably it's one of the biggest extensions of identity politics and feelings-based politics, that what I felt automatically had a link to something authentic or something true.
But I have to say to you, the left and the right do that.
That's true.
I spent a lot of time saying, I mean, haven't you seen that Newt Gingrich interview where he goes, but people feel that climate change isn't real? She's going, no, but it is real. He's like, but they feel it's not real. It's like, and then
they all exploit.
He's brought a feeling to a fact fight. But they all do it, yeah.
But I think the Trumper is in some ways a reversion to a more traditional view of man, like a moral religious view of man, versus I think one that was being driven by psychology and authenticity.
Final comment here.
This question's directed at Rebecca, but Tanvir might like to have something to say about it too. I was really, really, really shocked, Rebecca, when you came out right at the beginning and classified friendships as being between men and men and women and women. My husband is my best friend. My husband has several women friends that I don't particularly find interesting. and I have several men friends that he tolerates. And
that
I'm not
terrific.
Talking about sex.
I'm talking about
genuine friendships.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I find many women very boring.
All right. Well, I hope I won't bore you in my answer. I think that's fantastic. It isn't, I wouldn't say my experience or the research would show that that is typical. It is increasing, of your generation, which I assume is around my generation.
But,
that is the difference in generations. There's a lot more comfort in 20s and 30s of having, you know, even once after you've become a couple. You're in a relationship of having relationships are mixed. But as you would know, it's not very long ago in the spectrum of things that men and women weren't allowed to drink together. And the one thing that particularly European migrants notice here is that we still have a slightly segregated friendship circle. So it still exists. It's breaking down. That is terrific. I would, for some of these men that I'd meet, I'd like them to have any friend, male or female. It wouldn't bother me. It's, in fact, it would be even a greater sign of health that they had a couple of female friends that aren't the wives of their mates and that they don't want to sleep with. It's very good. That's something to aim for.
Can we find a comment?
I'm not sure. What I think Rebecca, covered that reasonably well. I guess hearing that, I was trying to think of some of my male patients and what are some of the trends there. And it is interesting, and Rebecca, and I would agree with her, it's something I see in my patients too, that certainly when you read psychology, anthropology, there has traditionally been an emphasis on men needing some sort of tribal outlet, like, i.e., you know, some sort of group activity. And that seems to be the need or what's happening there, I'm not so sure, but it does seem to be dwindling, whether they're not searching out for it or they don't have time for it. And that, I think, is an unusual modern trend. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I still see them all cycling on the bay that I live nearby, etc. Or more often solitary pursuits. But I think it goes back to, I think platonic friendships have increased. I think the richness of our intimate relationships has increased significantly, particularly for men. And I think that's an underrated phenomena. And I think men are starting to make the shift. Certainly middle class men are, but I think all sectors of men, and Rebecca alludes to this too, are starting to shift to a more, undertake more caring roles, have a broader, less traditional view of a kind of self-contained, solitary masculinity. That's my hope anyway.
Well, we could go on up, but we're pretty well out of time, and I have to leave. I have an appointment with myself in my shed. I've got to be going.
Is that what we call the Sydney Institute? It's the nicest shed in Sydney.
Thanks to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this great facility tonight. Many thanks to our speakers. Got a lot of very valuable insights, and their books are around. I'm sure both authors would be happy to sign either Fragile Nation or Still Lucky, but I'm sure Tanvir and Rebecca will be back again at the Sydney Institute. But for tonight, well done and good luck with your books.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.